Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
Odyssey is your new home for all the audio that matters to you. Download the Odyssey app today to listen to WTIC News Talk 1080.
In about an hour, we're going to be talking with Matthew Continetti. He's the author of a new book called The Right, an analysis of where Republicans are today and what's going on with the movement of conservatism. Fascinating guy. Fascinating, you know, really smart and articulate. And we will pick his brain and go through the issues with him. That's coming up in about an hour. And we've also got Kimberly Fiorello coming up in this hour, state representative, who is fascinating and highly devoted to principles. An unusual thing for somebody from the state House of Representatives, and yet there it is. There is a conservative values-based woman who's, I just think it's wonderful, who's a state rep. And we also have Joe Markley coming up in this hour as well. This is kind of the This is like the Liberty Hour or something. So this is a fun hour. Then we've got Matthew Continetti coming up, and then Jim Watkins. It's a power-packed show today. It's an all-star show. And then Nathan Carman is still on my mind, if you want to talk about that. 860-522-9842. Or leave comments at 860-751-4698. So I did a great setup. I guessed that we had really busy roads, and Mark Christopher hung me out to dry in the BPS Lawyers Traffic Center. I said, no.
I'm sorry about that.
It's the Todd Feinberg Show, live from the NJ Diet Studios on WTIC News Talk 1080.
WTIC, good afternoon. Can you believe it? It's time for Kimberly Fiorello, state representative from Greenwich, to join us. Hello there, Kimberly.
Hi, Todd. How are you guys?
Well, the question is, how are you now that the session has been over for a few days and you've had a chance to recover some sleep, maybe spend some time with your kids? You back in equilibrium?
Yeah, no, it's been great. And I actually went to my first Republican convention. I've never gone to one before. So that was very exciting to sort of end the whole legislative session with a hurrah party to launch all these statewide campaigns. But no, it is a great joy to be home with my kids. So thank you.
I'll bet it is. Well, thank you for taking the time to join us. So the before we get into a serious conversation about something, how about a quick mention of what your impression was? You said it was your first convention, and most people have no idea what goes on at a convention, and I'm not sure that anything really does. So what would you say about the experience?
You know, I really enjoyed most the competitive races. You know, just like anything else, it's really fun to go in and see to compare and contrast and see how the campaigns go for promoting themselves. So that was really something new for me to witness. You know, the uncompetitive races were, of course, our top of the ticket, the governor and lieutenant governor, and that was really wonderful to hear them come out and speak and really bring the whole group together. That was the first night. And then the second morning and day was the competitive races for Secretary of State and U.S. Senate. And so, and one of the privileges of working in the party and helping and volunteering is you do get chosen to be a delegate. And, you know, you're in a room full of all the many volunteers and people who care so much that they put their time and effort into working in the party, and we all gathered to put, you know, our
name. So that's
on
that. They made it unusual for you to be with a bunch of Republican activists and feel the sense of community and shared mission.
Yes, the sense of camaraderie is wonderful. You get that, you know, anytime you go to an RTC meeting or you get together for events that are like-minded, but you know, to have a whole convention room full of fellow Republicans is a great feeling. And to hear each candidate putting their best foot forward, and then, you know, I believe it's all in the best spirit of trying to make our party stronger, putting forward the best candidate. And, you know, competition is not comfortable, but it's rigorous, and that's great for us. So I really enjoyed being a part of that.
Good. All right, Kimberly, tell us about the budget.
Well, thanks so much. I know that there's a lot of, you know, celebratory rounds going around with the biggest, you know, biggest tax cut. But I did put out an e-blast on the budget, and there's, you know, there's good stuff in there. There's a lot of nonprofits across our state that are getting boosted state grants. But I wanted to bring to light, you know, some things that not many folks, well, certainly the media is not talking about. But, you know, for the most part, this is not really a great budget because it still increases government spending. This is a readjustment of the second fiscal year of the biennial budget, and it still goes up by $500 million. And, or, you know, 6.4% more spending from the original version of fiscal year 23 to now the revised version. And then the question is, what are we spending our money on?
Wait a sec. You said it's a 6% increase?
Yes, 6.4%.
Over what was projected just a year ago when they did the budgets.
Right, over what was planned. You know, they planned this amount, a particular amount of spending, and they now have new ideas.
And well, not just new ideas, but presumably there was a 4 or 5% increase when they did this year's budget, next year's budget, last year, and so now it's got to be up over 10%.
So this is right, the sort of baked in increase. This is more. This is on top of the usual increase that
which means
government growth.
So even if it's not, I just want to frame this. That means taxes are going up even if they haven't gone up this year, that what they have built into the budget is a big tax hike whenever the need for more cash hits us, which will probably be next year.
There certainly is a fiscal cliff. There's more spending. It will require tax raises at some point if we're going to cover our bills.
Well, we can't cover our bills. They keep kicking. I mean, even last year, the governor kicked a bunch of debt for pension obligations and stuff down the road. And I was listening to his 2019 budget address, you know, his first budget address, and he was talking about how he felt badly, but the only way to survive fiscal situation of the state when he came into office was to take some of those obligations and refinance them so that they wouldn't have to be paid at that moment. It strikes me there's this big cover-up going on, but go ahead. I don't want to take you off course.
No, that's okay. I think there's a cover-up or a sleight of hand, or there's basically just not the full truth, straightforwardness coming to the residents. And how can it? You know, this is another 700-page bill dropping at 4:30 a.m. But
with no time for you guys to absorb it, you mean?
Right. So it came to us at 4:30 a.m. on Monday, and we voted on it on Monday.
And you never saw this 700 pages before?
Not in its whole. No, not in whole.
People have to realize that the change of a word in a section could give the section a whole different meaning. And the only way to really know what the implication of a 700-page document where any number of words could be changed would be to have a team of lawyers ready to go over it, and it could take weeks.
Right, it could. And, you know, there's something for everyone in this bill. So if you go through it, or when lawmakers go through it, there's stuff where they could say, like, oh, you know, this is in my district. This is good for my community. I know people who are working on this. And that is a tough one to understand, to swallow or vote against. But what I want to flag for the residents of Connecticut are some of these, like, really insidious ideological things that are in this budget bill that people have to understand, because it shows a shift. And it really shows that the priorities of our Democrat-ruled state. And one of the things that really jumped out at me is in Section 92 of the budget, it includes new language that the governor must guide the economy based on equity of outcomes. And there's a whole section, I don't want to go through the wordiness of it, but it is about identifying and remedying patterns of discrimination, inequality, disparities in outcome, and that
which is patently against the whole idea of having a free society. If you're guaranteeing outcomes, that means that you're an unfree society, that you're responsible for, first of all, there's a randomness to whose outcome you're going to be concerned about. It's political. And that's driven by the party in power, and they're doing it in order to satisfy blocks of voters who they want to get their votes. So it's totally the wrong way to approach government.
It really is. And, you know, we see this in our businesses that are adopting, you know, equity policies for work, or in our school system. But this is in the governor's budget bill. And this is the lens through which our governor is now expected to guide our economy, his economic policies. And to me, this is a major red flag. You don't want an economy that is, you know, so principled on equal outcomes. It's just the total opposite of what the country was founded on. And it is exactly what will drive so many people who want a meritocratic society out of Connecticut. The problem is, Connecticut, you know, we're one of 50. We have to realize, like, this is not a vacuum. People are not trapped here. You build an economy based on equity outcomes, and people will quickly realize, like, it ain't happening here, and they can move. And that's what, these politicians don't seem to realize is, you know, people have choices, even if they try to take our choices away.
Well, you're assuming, Kimberly, that they care about the best interests of the state. If a big chunk of the state leaves that doesn't agree with them, you suggest that to a political party, they're bound to say, wow, how do we do that? That's a good idea. How do we get our opponents, people who would vote for our opponents, to leave the state? This is wonderful.
And, you know, to me, a lot of our listeners, your listeners and people across the state, they and across the political spectrum, they really had an instinctive response to these zoning bills that, you know, were initially the group that was pushing these wanted to get rid of, like, single family zoning, for example. And those kinds of ideas are based on this concept of equity of outcomes. It's not fair. It's not fair. It's unjust. However they couch it, but everybody is not equal. We have people who live on multiple acres, and they cast that in a light of there's something wrong. They've taken more than their fair share. And then in medicine, with COVID policies, you know, there was a current article that talked about the state's policy to focus on, and these are their words, it was a Black and Hispanic communities because they are more at risk. But you're talking about targeting specific communities for vaccinations, and it's all race-based as opposed to, I don't know, why not
socioeconomic, geographical? There's all kinds of ways you might do it that would be equal treatment under the law as opposed to just singling out the two highest proportion voter blocks for the Democratic Party and saying, let's give them more stuff because they're troubled. You know, they're failed communities. If they're failed communities, if they are underserved communities, the people doing the underserving are the same ones who want to pay them all this extra money.
Right, exactly. So I just want people to understand that this word equity, I mean, it's everywhere now, but it was inserted into the budget, and it's to be a major guideline for the governor and his economic policies. Another one, and this was pretty insidious, is this is a bill. It was state health care for undocumented children up to the age of 12 and grandfathered up to the age of 19. And this bill failed in the Human Services Committee along bipartisan lines. It was so controversial in committee that both parties were like, "This, we're not putting this forward."
And what, they jammed it through afterwards? Or they put it inside the budget?
It's in the budget.
So they take something that Democrats and Republicans alike found to be bad or even abhorrent, and they just paste it into the budget, and everybody votes on the budget which they haven't even read or considered, and that
right.
passes easily.
This is right. So it's in the budget, and now it's law because it passed, and the governor signed it. And so now, you know, we will all be supporting undocumented children up to the age of 12, and then they say grandfathered up to 19. I don't know why they make that distinction, but I think they really wanted to be able to say it's only up to 12.
Right.
But, you know,
they want to be able to misrepresent it because that's the best way to get things, you know, people to shrug their shoulders. We're talking to State Representative Kimberly Fiorello from Greenwich. Kimberly, that's great to get on the table for everybody to understand. Like, that's really tangible. Most people don't understand why people in the country illegally are allowed to stay rather than deported. And now we're talking about ways to give things to people who've broken into the country.
Well, and something that, you know, that failed in committee along both lines. So, you know, representative lawmakers of these other communities all said, like, this isn't going to work. You can't pass this. And the ranking member, the Republican member of the committee, mm-hmm. spoke on the floor and said, why bother having committees if something fails in committee and you stick it in the bill anyways? But we are a sanctuary state. That's something people have to remember. Connecticut it's not that we have sanctuary cities within our state. It's that we are a sanctuary state that does not abide by federal immigration laws. And in a way, we are aiding and abetting in one of the worst atrocities of human trafficking. And Connecticut is not, you know, we're not playing our part in advancing legal immigration. Mm-hmm. I mean, every time a politician has the microphone, we should be talking about fixing the legal immigration system. But instead, we are aiding and abetting, you know, what really, if we shine the light on the whole business of undocumented migrants crossing into America, whether it's, I know many overstay their visas, but many do go through a treacherous journey to get here. And I live in Greenwich, which is on the border of the Westchester Airport, where flights are coming in, you know,
and that's one
3,
of the
4 a.m.
Yeah, all right, we've got to wrap it right there. Kimberly, thank you so much for bringing this to our attention. It's so much good information, and we'll see you next week. Rest that poor voice of yours, though, would you?
Oh, now I'm just having too much fun with the children. But
thank you,
Todd. Thank you for all you guys do.
State Representative Kimberly Fiorello from Greenwich. Man, that's some horrifying stuff, isn't it?
Miss
something from the Todd Feinberg Show? Listen to the podcast on WTIC.com/podcast.
Pretty interesting, though, isn't it? The U.S. Senate, Democrats in control, could only get 49 votes in favor of their bill, which means there was bipartisan opposition. If they were writing the headlines the way they usually do, they would say bipartisan opposition to the Democrats' abortion bill. Joe Manchin, the Democrat from West Virginia, said that he said in advance that he was going to vote no on the Democratic bill, his party, arguing it's too broad. He said he would support a codification of Roe versus Wade, but he said this bill goes too far. It's an interesting thing that the Democrats want to play up the fact that they wrote a piece of legislation that they can't even get all of their members to vote for, let alone be able to pull some Republicans into it. Because I'm sure there's some Republicans who wouldn't mind voting for something that that left the present political moment in place. But maybe I'm wrong about that. I don't know. I would think there'd be some. 860-522-9842. All right, what's coming up? We've got, I was going to say Joe Manchin. We don't have Joe Manchin coming up. We have Joe Markley coming up in just a couple of minutes. Joe Manchin, I've been trying to get him on, but he hasn't responded. Yeah, he's the West Virginia senator who basically controls what Democrats can do, because he won't vote for things that he sees as being outside of the mainstream. And he represents a conservative, Trump-voting state. So, and he's the only Democrat elected statewide in the state of West Virginia. So, you know, that's how it works. And the Democrats wanted to have this vote so that they could draw a line in the sand, because they're desperately trying to figure out a way to not get swamped in the November elections. And with home heating oil over $6 a gallon and with gas at close to $5 a gallon, they have, and inflation just going crazy, and you can't even buy, you know, they broke the economy with COVID, and now you can't even buy formula, baby formula. Like, they have made a mess of the world with their hyper big government and with their desire to control everything. And what's interesting about their controlling everything is that reveals how little they can control things when they're actually asked to or given the power to. So this, I don't know that this is going to work for them, but they've got nothing else to try, is the way they look at it. So let's run around screaming like madmen and see what we can make happen. That's how the Democrats are looking at it. Because what else do we have to work with?
Now back to the Todd Feinberg Show, live from the NJ Diet Studios on WTIC News Talk 1080.
Good afternoon to you. Wednesday afternoon. It's amazing how fast weeks go by. It is. And here we are with Joe Markley again. That's the good part of weeks going by so far, is you bump up against Joe Markley so quick again. Hi, Joe.
Hello. Good to be with you again, Todd. I saw you, of course, briefly at the convention, but we didn't really get too much chance.
Well, wait a sec. What happened? I saw you on the way in, and that was it, right?
Yeah, I actually wandered over to that little corner where they stuck you, and I was waiting around to see if I could sneak in. But you had a line of notables ready to go on the air, and I figured you had your hands full already.
Oh, I'm sorry we didn't get a chance to have you on. It would have been fun. And I love how you described where they stuck us, because that's what happened. But it was partially our fault, because we didn't book it as early as we should have.
Well, you know, when I was filling in a couple of weeks ago, Joey Burgoyne said, "Oh, we've tried to get in touch with the Connecticut Republicans. We haven't heard back from them." So I sent a message to Ben Proto and the executive director and said, hey, can you track these guys down? And I think they did it shortly thereafter. But
Well, that was late. We'd been trying for, I think, a month before that or something. But
well,
anyway.
Always ask. At least
anyway, we'll cover the Democrat one in 4 years, and that'll be more fun. We'll get to sit in the corner and take pot shots at them.
Hey, you know, Kim Fiorella is a wonderful state representative, and she's also modest because she didn't mention the fact that she gave not one but two nominating speeches at the convention, which shows the esteem that she's held in.
Oh, really? That's a noteworthy thing?
Oh, yes. Well, I mean, each candidate gets a nominator and a second. And I think both the speeches Kim gave were nominating speeches. And I think it was for, my goodness, I think Leora Levy and Dominic Rapini for Secretary of State. And curiously enough, the only other person to give two nominating speeches was our good friend Rob Sampson, who gave a speech for Leora Levy's opponent, Peter Lumage, and Dominic Rapini's opponent, Brock Weber. But that shows that people can disagree without necessarily being enemies, because obviously...
Well, I don't know. They could still be there fighting over at the casino.
I don't think so. she did a great job, too. I talked to her a little bit about it, having done that before, about the fact that you've kind of got to raise your excitement level when you stand up in front of a big crowd like that. And as you could see, a big crowd that isn't necessarily paying attention to what's going on.
Yes, but they're also a big crowd that's fired up and wants to be fired up. And they're in the mood to do some rah-rahing, to build this sense of camaraderie and excitement over the election. It is a big thing to turn the corner of the convention and to have candidates in place for some races and others narrow down to a couple of people or what have you, and to start moving forward and get serious about this thing.
Yes, and it's more narrowed down than usual in that there's no contest for governor, for lieutenant governor. One contest on the under ticket for Secretary of State and a U.S. Senate race. And probably there's a good chance that there's not going to be any primaries at the congressional level. So if that kind of party unity is a good thing, I think the Republicans are in good shape. One worries sometimes that the lack of a contest is not necessarily because everyone agrees, but that nobody cares.
Well, or that nobody can muster the strength. Even worse, that there aren't people positioned in such a way that they think it's a viable run for them to make. On the other hand. The thing that worries me the most, Joe, is it's good to have candidates, I think, especially ones who don't have a ton of experience. But even if you're running, you know, you might have experience in a state rep or a state senate seat, but to run for Congress is a new thing, and you have to get your handle on what you want to say about those national issues. And it's good to have somebody to run against so you can get good at your campaign before you face the big guy.
Yeah, so a little shakedown cruise. You know, you're absolutely right about the, especially with the public financing program for state legislative elections and also for state officers, for governor and so forth. The congressional races don't have that public financing. And the result is that somebody who's been a state senator or a state representative that then decides to run for Congress discovers that the job is all about fundraising. And I think that's often a problem. And I think we see, hey, we got a couple of great candidates, men I really respect, coming out of the legislature to run for Congress. George Logan in the 5th District, Mike France in the 2nd District. And they have worked hard, but I think they've discovered just how tough it is to raise money for a congressional campaign when there's no match involved. It's not like you can say, hey, all I have to do is get to 75,000 and I'm done. Mm-hmm. This is like you got to raise money every day right up to the day before the election.
Well, wait a sec, Joe Markley. You sound like you're making an argument in favor of the government funding system.
In a funny way, it's an argument against it in the sense that because legislators don't have to do it anymore, the muscle has kind of atrophied. And I feel like when they make that jump from the state legislature to a congressional race,
they're beginners.
Than it would be otherwise. They're beginners, exactly. Not
wow,
like
that's not I hadn't state thought state. Of that. What an interesting thing. So it's a way to neuter the opposition, so they're never in shape to take you on.
Well, and you know, it's also as much the donors who become weaklings, because you get to the point where you say, oh, gee, I wrote a check for $5 or $10 to the state rep candidate, mm-hmm. and I've helped them out. And if you are a legislative candidate, even getting those small checks is very helpful, because you have to get this certain number of people in the district and so forth. But when you're running for Congress, you're saying, $5 is just covering the postage. 50 or 100 or 500 is what you've got to be looking for. And that's a big ask. And you have to be comfortable making it, and you have to have a list of people that will listen to that request if you make it.
So looking at the macro of where the Republican-Democrat relationship to the electorate is right now for the state of Connecticut, how do you feel about this as a year? Is this a good one for Republicans, or a poor one, or something in between?
You know, you don't know what the weather is going to be until the day actually arrives. And I guess one thing I'd say is, 6 or 8 months ago, an awful lot of people were saying, oh, gee, we don't have a chance against Ned Lamont, right? He's so popular coming out of COVID and all that sort of stuff. Well, the COVID glow has kind of gone away. And added to that has been the fact of these scandals, clearly scandals, going on in the Office of Policy and Management, and elsewhere, immediately in his immediate circle as governor. And I think that has given hope to Republicans. But at the same time, something you've talked about, I feel like scandal is not the thing that's going to bring down Lamont, because people look at him and say, I think he's an honest man. I just don't think he's a particularly good administrator. Mm-hmm. And that's the Achilles heel, I think, that Republicans are going to have to find a way to hit. And of course, the other thing that concerns people is, does this Roe versus Wade decision, by bringing abortion back as a big issue, hurt Republicans? And it certainly has put, for instance, Bob Stefanowski in a hot seat. There was an article in the Connecticut Mirror today about the fact that Stefanowski has not spoken out about his running mate's vote on this abortion bill recently. And I think it's probably a mistake, because if you don't talk about it before, somebody's going to ask you about it at a debate. And it's hard to say, well, read my statement. I mean, you're right there live. And better to
practice,
figure out what you want to say about it and say it as soon as possible.
Yeah, I can't imagine it's particularly complicated. It might be, maybe he was just trying to wait till he got past the convention before he started responding to those kinds of questions. I don't know. It's interesting.
Possibly. Basically, you say, do you agree with that vote? And you can yes, no, or with limitations. But I think it's going to be hard for him to put distance between himself and Laura Devlin. I think it's something he doesn't want to do. And I rather
aren't we not supposed to question women on such a thing? Like, why would if you have a team of a guy running for governor and a woman running to be his lieutenant governor, and she votes her conscience on a piece of legislation having to do with abortion, then Democrats would say, oh, well, I'm with him. He should not be stepping in. I would just imagine he would say, well, look at what's going on. That's up to her to decide. I'm not going to tell her. I'm not going to tell a woman how to vote on an abortion bill. That wouldn't be right. And then all the Democrats would go, yeah, I guess he's got a point there, doesn't he?
Well, I don't know that it's a matter of saying I'm going to tell her what to do. It's more a question of saying, given that this issue is a hot one before the public right now, is that a position that you share? And that strikes me as a legitimate issue. There's ways to kind of dance around it.
No, it's all legitimate. And I think that ultimately it's great to be asked those questions. But, everybody decides when they're going to start answering questions that are being fired their way. For example, Ned yesterday at the end of a press conference was asked a couple of questions. He was going after Bob for not talking about abortion. And then Ned got hit with a question about his scandals and the fact that the black woman who he fired as the head of the Department of Public Health was filed suit against him this week. And suddenly there was crickets from Ned. He he choked up and didn't know what to say. So
he said, Josh.
Yes, exactly. Where is the great Josh when you need him?
Yeah. Well, Josh has put some distance between himself and this whole administration, but I'm sure we will be hearing from him again as these scandals unravel. But I think if you're going to have to take a position on something,
do it quick and get it over.
Get it over with, and it becomes old news. And I would say too, I don't think there's any shame. Now, I don't know how Stefanowski feels about it, but I don't think there's any shame in disagreeing more or less with your running mate. I mean,
sure.
Say, hey, we're two different people. You know, I don't imagine they had JFK and LBJ on a ticket together in 1960. I can't imagine they agreed on everything.
It's a sign of maturity and adulthood.
Yeah, they had different parts of the Republican Party, different parts of the country that they represented. And you'd kind of say maybe it's healthy to have multiple voices in the room.
On the other hand, you and I aren't even running mates, but we seem to agree on everything.
Pretty much everything. Although, you know, you've got a little bit more libertarian. If we sat down and had dinner again sometime.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I think that I often say, just like myself and Rob Sampson, I feel like Rob is a little bit more of a libertarian and I'm a little bit more of a conservative in that I would say, if this is the way we've always done it, I'm not against continuing to do it that way. This is even if I can't defend the particular law.
So you've got instincts to do the wrong thing just because it's been done for a long time that way?
Do you know that there's a metaphor that's called Chesterton's fence?
Uh-huh.
And G.K. Chesterton, who was a great thinker and a great conservative, said if you're out in a field and you find a fence and you can't see any reason for it to exist, one person's instinct would be to say, let's take this fence down. And another person's instinct would be to say, I'm not taking it down until I figure out why it got put up in the first place. And Chesterton said the libertarian would say, take down the fence. And the conservative would say, let's not be hasty about it.
Well, I would say it depends on whether you need the firewood or not.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, you can't do anything with a repealed law. You can't you can't burn it for light or heat or anything. it's just gone. But,
all right, Joe Markley, great to talk with you as always. Thank you, sir, and thank you for telling me that you're more conservative than I am. I didn't realize that.
More
by the way, we've got
libertarian.
We've got Matthew Continetti coming up. In the next half hour. Do you know him? He's got this book out on the right.
I know him as a writer, and I love him. I'm delighted. In fact, now I got to keep listening.
Yes, I wanted to put you in that box. That was exactly my intention with a little tease. Thank you, Joe Markley. We'll talk to you next week. Appreciate it.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during O'Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, oh.